Information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge,
we care.
And
it shows.
The law?
The
country.
You will remember nine you have seen.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
A government they were innocent and they have no idea what they're up against.
A state of war only serves as an excuse for domestic tyranny. Welcome, my friends, to episode 86 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's 888, August 8th, 2008. My name is James Evan Pilato, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network. Tons to go over this week. Olympic tyranny, Amerithrax suicide, chain Iranian false flags, 9/11 Iraq link lies, Limbaugh and the Bush crime family, more Minot, less freedom, Denver terror and a nuclear error, spokes drones, and the TSA's emo screening. It's all here. It's 2 weeks plus worth of news. It's episode 86, August 8th, 2008, and it's MediaMonarchy.com. Psycho. That's brand new music from The Faint. Their new record is called Fascination. and they were just in Portland last week, but damn it, I did not get to see them. I was out of town. I was on my East Coast tour, hit my three big cities, Shepherdstown, Manhattan, and Fayetteville. You know, the big three. So yeah, the Faint's new record is called Fascination. In both spots where the eyes are, there's two eyes, so it almost looks like Fasci Nation, which of course we are. If you look at the symbology of the hatchet head in the bundle of sticks, that's a fasci. It's in our Houses of Congress. But I digress. It's good to be back here in the Portland Radio Authority. Fridays at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, praradio.org, and also revereradionetwork.com. Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time, and also 95.3 KBFR in Boulder and 87.9 Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta. Huge thanks out to them for rebroadcasting Media Monarchy. And you can, of course, hit me up on MySpace and Dig and YouTube and Yahoo and IM, Skype and Twitter, all with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And, of course, get the podcast from iTunes, radioforall.net, and archive.org. I had a well-needed, well-deserved vacation. It was good and great to be with family and friends. Remind you of what's really important. Now, there were moments when you're traveling around in the airport and you're just overcome with all the people, and it makes me almost want to wig out and just, oh, I was fucking wrong about everything. We're stupid cattle and we deserve every fucking thing we get. But no, I don't really feel that way. There were moments of it, though. But I can shake that off. And 2 weeks ago, Media Monarchy came to you from 89.7 WSHC in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. It was nice to get back into my ass groove there. And I want to send a word out to my man Buck, faculty advisor at WSHC. I worked under him. Not doing real well. And I won't get into all of that, but I send him my words and prayers and hopes. Another thing, when I was in Fayetteville, going to the old swimming pool, I got to go to the nice 4-H pool that I hadn't been to in probably 15 years, and we're cruising down to it, and I'm flipping around on the dial, and of course you always go down towards the bottom of the dial, because that's where the good stuff is. And appropriately enough, on 89.7, somewhere in Fayetteville or Fayette County, somebody was broadcasting live GCN and the Alex Jones Show. I have not been able to find the affiliate list and whether that's an official affiliate or if somebody else out there has some LPFM action and they were broadcasting Alex Jones. So to hear Alex Jones in my hometown of Fayetteville really blew my mind, and it was just another point that gave me some hopeful thoughts that people are waking up. It's just not fast enough. One more word. Yours truly in Media Monarchy is listed as this month's featured show on praradio.org. They wrote up a nice little blurb. It's awesome, and I may actually have to use that blurb. It's always easier to have someone else write a blurb than you write it yourself. But I think that's all the business I have to take care of, because now we have to get to the serious business. And so there's a lot. There's no way I'll get to go over all of it, because I'm 2-plus weeks behind. But we're going to hit the most important stuff first, although it's hard to judge what's more important. But it's, of course, 888. And at 8:08 a.m., the totalitarian Olympics have kicked off, echoing 1936 Olympics. So let's start it out a little right, and let's learn about the Beijing Olympics and wonder if they're a trap.
Welcome. I am Robert Braun, filling in Clifford Baines today, who is not handling his divorce too well. The Chinese government has spent billions of dollars on the 2008 Olympics. It will be in Beijing. How can we be sure that the whole thing is not a trap?
No, we can be sure that it is a trap. They've been preparing for this for thousands of years.
What kind of trap should we be expecting?
According to satellite images that we got from Beijing, they are digging large holes, which they claim are for Olympic venues. But we know full well that they're going to cover them up with branches and leaves, and the athletes from America are going to fall right into them.
Oh, they're going to wait until it gets dark, and they're going to bring out their dragons. Uh-huh.
It's most likely going to be during the opening ceremonies when we're all together under one roof.
Sounds like a disaster.
We have to look at Falun Gong. These aged Chinese in their parks training to become killing machines.
Falun Gong, very dangerous.
What they're doing is they're practicing slow motion fight scenes.
If you speed them up, they could cause a lot of damage.
I think that we should send in the pole vaulters first, or like a canary in the coal mine.
They've got all of those stone warriors just waiting for the right magic spell, and they come alive, and they'll take our athletes and tie them to the trees.
Well, I'm actually planning on going myself to the Olympics.
No.
Are you serious?
No, I'm a lifelong gymnastics fan. But I will admit it, I am scared for my life.
Thank you, Onion. As always, doing satire right, just a little bit of tweaking. Beijing Olympics, are they a trap? And of course they are. But let's get into the seriousness of the trap. So post it up under Beijing Olympics weather mod, RFID, and a vulgar display of power. First up from Financial Times, China's rain stoppers faced big test. Of all the Chinese officials working behind the scenes to produce a flawless Olympics ceremony on Friday evening, few face a task as daunting as those in charge of making sure it does not rain. Staff from China's weather modification departments have deployed aircraft, artillery, and rocket launchers to ward off rain before the three-hour ceremony in Beijing's spectacular but roofless Bird's Nest Stadium. Now, of course, time and time again, we've gone over China and their weather modification. Of course, they're using the rudimentary cloud seeding form of weather modification, but we know from treaties signed between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union that we swore we wouldn't use weather weapons. And if you hit the link about the bird's nest, you of course see that they've covered up tons and tons of deaths as they were rushing to complete their roofless bird's nest stadium. So next, if we jump to CNET, by way of my man Doug at blacklistednews.com, RFID goes prime time in Beijing Olympics. Radio frequency identification, RFID technology, will be facing one of its first major tests during the Beijing Olympics, taking care of ticketing for the estimated 3 million athletes, journalists, and spectators. Despite the Chinese government's current uptight security measures, that's a nice way to put it, the RFID chips embedded in Olympic tickets will not be carrying personal information. Instead, they'll be linked to a remote database designed primarily to combat counterfeits, facilitate check-in, and so on and so on. Following the recent food scare originating from China, local authorities will also be using RFID-based food management systems to maintain close tabs on food production, processing, and deliveries. The arrangement may be a lot more significant than the one mentioned above, considering the well-being of close to 10,700 international athletes and the daunting logistics of pulling off events across 31 competition venues throughout the country. Now, there's also a link in there where you can, of course, read about how RFID chips, whether they're in tickets or Campbell's soup, or in your passports, are, of course, utterly hackable. You can link over to Beta News and read about the unhackable e-passport was hacked within moments. But the last one, under this heading of a vulgar display of power, Beijing Olympics, another vulgar celebration of greed and corporatist values. This from Len Hart at Existentialist Cowboy. Not since 1936 has a police state hosted an Olympics amid such international turmoil. So, of course, the Beijing regime that brought you the massacre at Tiananmen Square, they're easily bought off, at least temporarily, by makers of sneakers and other shameless exploiters of labor and humanity. The world has not seen extravagance on this scale since another tyrant, some guy named Adolf, tried to exploit the Olympics to put a smiley face on Nazism. Now, of course, you can hit the flashback link there and read about how, of course, the torch running ceremony is straight out of the Nazi playbook. And, of course, we still follow those plays to this day. And you can always get into the West's connection to the Nazi Empire, whether it's IBM and their Hollerith punch cards facilitating the Final Solution, or whether it's Bayer or Bertelsmann AG or any of it, I don't want to forget, you know, Prescott Bush and UBC and all the dirty Nazi dealings. So, dovetailing, speaking of Bush, now under the heading, the Totalitarian Olympics to begin in Beijing, this from McClatchy, China is grateful that the Bush crime family is coming to the Olympics. When Chinese leaders gaze into stadium stands Friday and see President Bush and his extended crime family watching the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, they'll feel strong gratitude for his presence. Gone will be any ill feeling about his lashing of China's human rights record a day earlier and his call for the nation to grant freedom and rights to its people.
Just hours before his arrival in Beijing, and with all eyes on the kickoff of the Summer Olympics, President Bush has used some of his bluntest language yet to denounce China's human rights record. To an audience in Thailand, he voiced deep concerns about the communist regime's continuing crackdown on dissent.
The United States believes the people of China deserve the fundamental liberty that is a natural right of all human beings. So America stands in firm opposition to China's detention of political dissidents and human rights advocates and religious activists.
Bush acknowledged his words will likely irk China's leaders, but said he's convinced freedom will help China prosper. And he made a prediction.
Change in China will arrive on its own terms and in keeping with its own history and its own traditions. Your change will arrive.
Bush's speech came as he finished 2 days of visiting key U.S. allies, South Korea and Thailand.
Yeah, we'll do it together.
In the Thai capital, he toured a sitter for street kids and AIDS victims and met with dissidents from neighboring Myanmar, using the session to chide that country's military rulers, too, about brutal repression in what he still calls Burma.
You know, the American people care deeply about Burma, and we dream for the day in which people will be free.
What remained to be seen was how blunt-spoken Bush would be during his 4 days in Beijing, where he said his main goal will be to take part in the Olympic Games as a sports fan and longtime friend of China. Mark Smith, The Associated Press, Bangkok.
Another classic pot kettle black moment from Shrub. Of course, you know, things like criticizing Zimbabwean elections, you know, with Mugabe a few weeks ago. Of course, he has the gall to say that the elections were suspect. Now, of course, he has to give some lip service to, you know, saying, China, rabbity-bah. But we know where they stand. We know that China is the model. That's why they win most favored nation status by the UN, because they are the model of a New World Order nation. Whether it's brutal repression, censorship, or eugenics and one-child policies, it's all there for you. So, if we jump to the next one from Wikinews, group claims activists held in China after protests. The nonprofit student-led organization Students for a Free Tibet, which seeks to make Tibet a separate country from China, has claimed that some of its activists have been detained in Beijing after protesting near an Olympic stadium, holding banners such as One World, One Dream, Free Tibet, and Tibet Will Be Free. The British Embassy in Beijing is investigating these reports, which involved two Britons and two Americans. A British Embassy spokesman said that they are in touch with the Chinese authorities and are requesting immediate consular access should this information be correct. If we jump to the Washington Post, foreign activists pierce China's broad security apparatus. China's intense efforts to block any protest that would mar the Olympic Games were challenged Wednesday by foreign activists equally bent on diverting attention to issues as varied as Tibetan independence, the crisis in Darfur, and religious freedom. Two American and two British protesters slipped through a smothering Olympic security net, climbed a pair of lampposts, and unfurled banners demanding freedom for Tibet near the new stadium where the Beijing Games are to open Friday night. In Tiananmen Square, three American Christian activists spoke out against China's rights record and protested its population control policies. The four pro-Tibet protesters have been deported, while a second demonstration by Christian activists on Thursday was disrupted when plainclothes police removed the protesters from Tiananmen Square. So, if we jump to Reuters, China security drags away U.S. protesters. Chinese plainclothes security officials dragged away three American Christian activists on Thursday after they dared attempt to protest for religious freedom for a second day in Beijing's main Tiananmen Square.
We have come here today to speak out against the human rights abuses of the Chinese government. We have come here today to be a voice who have no voice of their own. We are a voice for those who are in prison because of their religious belief. We are a voice for those. We are a voice for those of the Falun Gong practitioners. We speak for those who have brutalized the Tiananmen Square. We're not walking on our own. We're being pushed out.
Ben.
So there you have it. Activists being dragged away by Chinese plain-clothed police. And it's all just now getting underway. That's just a little bit of the last couple days. Protests, deportation, weather modification, RFID, the totalitarian Olympics. So keep an eye peeled to MediaMonarchy.com for all the latest developments in what is sure to be a disastrous Olympics. And of course it is 888. They start at 808. Globalist love, numerology, and even the little Olympic rings almost look like an 888. I was going to try while I was on vacation to crank out a couple extra episodes of Media Monarchy, thereby skewing, you know, the episode list so that today I could be doing episode 88 on 888. But it didn't happen, and my girlfriend didn't want me to do it anyway. She said it was shady, and she's probably right. So anyway, let's shift gears to the other huge, huge, huge news of the last 2 weeks. So, breaking 2 weeks ago today, I had been on the road. I got home, cracked open the laptop. First thing that hit me, the supposed lone anthrax gunman supposedly commits suicide. And, of course, we should always immediately think that he was probably suicided. Whether it's Gary Webb or Deborah Jean Palfrey, the DC Madam. I have massive, massive links and research and materials on the anthrax false flag operation. That's probably going to have to wait for the B-side episode. So what I'm going to do now is just hit the main points. So, first, from the Associated Press. Anthrax-laced letters that killed five people and severely rattled the post-9/11 nation may have been part of an Army scientist's warped plan to test his cure for the deadly toxin. The brilliant but troubled scientist committed suicide this week before prosecutors could charge him with murder. No, they're not talking about Lee Harvey Oswald. Oh, damn, he's dead. I guess we don't have a trial now. The sudden naming of scientist Bruce E. Ivins, I-V-I-N-S, as the top and perhaps only suspect in the anthrax attacks marks the latest bizarre twist in a case that has confounded the FBI for nearly 7 years. Oh, we just screwed it up. The incompetence theory. Last month, the Justice Department, I use the term loosely, cleared Ivan's colleague, Stephen Hatfield, which we covered on the show, who had been wrongly suspected in the case, and they paid him $5.8 million for playing along. Thanks for playing, Stephen. Here's $6 million. Shut up. Ivan's worked at the Army's Biological Warfare Labs at good old Fort Detrick in Maryland. I was so near there while I was on vacation. For 18 years until his death, he worked at Fort Detrick. He was one of the government's leading scientists researching vaccines and cures for anthrax exposure. But he also had a long history of homicidal threats, according to papers filed last week in a local court by a social worker.
A source is telling CNN that a suspect in the 2001 anthrax mailings has committed suicide just as the Justice Department was considering filing charges against him. The source says Bruce Ivins died on Tuesday. Justice correspondent Kelly Arena, of course, is working her sources, joins us live from Washington with the very latest on the story. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning, Melissa. Here's what we know. Bruce Ivins was a government anthrax researcher. He committed suicide this week after he was informed that the government was going to file charges against him in relation to the anthrax attacks, which happened back in 2001. Now, Ivins had worked for more than three decades at the Army's Biodefense Research Lab over in Fort Detrick, Maryland. Sources tell us that the FBI has actually traced the anthrax that was used in the attacks back to that lab. We're also told by sources that Ivins was one of the scientists who was questioned very early on in this process and was also one of the many who had done some work with the FBI as they pursued this investigation. Investigators were pretty convinced all along that whoever the anthrax killer was, that that person had to have some sort of scientific background because the anthrax was what they call weapons grade, very complicated to make. And we called the FBI, we called the Department of Justice. They are refusing comment. But this is a major breakthrough in a case that many people had thought had just gone cold. I mean, the government had issued 6,000 grand jury subpoenas. They've conducted 9,000 interviews. They've pursued 50,000 leads in this investigation, but not one arrest had been made. Now, ironically enough, Ivins worked at the same facility as a man named Stephen Hatfill. Now, you may remember him. He was named very publicly a person of interest in the anthrax investigation. He actually reached a settlement just recently with the government, multi-million dollar settlement. He had always claimed that he had nothing to do with the attacks and was cleared. You know, at this point, we're not exactly sure what the charges against Ivins were going to be. We're hoping that now that the story's out there, the Department of Justice will come forward with some sort of statement. Unfortunately, you know, Ivins is now deceased, so we may never really know motive or you know, the whole story. But let's see what they have when they finally decide to tell us.
9,000 interviews, again, 24 agents working on the case. We don't know, again, at this point, why now, right? 2008 versus this development, unfortunately, right after 9/11.
Well, you know, the FBI had done a lot of work on the science end of this, hoping that that would lead to the killer. It was something they had never confronted before. Protocols had to be put in place. You know, they had to really start from ground zero here and try to go forward in the best way that they could, so that whatever they came up with could be prosecutable in the end. And you know, they. You know, we've been told all along that they were honing in on the scientific community. You know, every now and then you would hear that the circle of people that they were looking at was getting smaller. I talked with FBI Director Robert Mueller just a few weeks ago about this, and he said that he was very confident that the FBI would come forward with the anthrax killer, that case would be solved. I tried to press him at that time on the issue, and he said, let's just call it a breakthrough. We'll see. So, you know, this has been... a very difficult case to solve, obviously, but mostly because of the science that was involved and because a lot of people had to get up to speed on that front, and that's not something that happens overnight, Melissa.
Well, thank you for bringing us up to speed on this complicated case as well. Justice Correspondent Kelly Arena from Washington. Kelly, thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, you heard they said that the FBI investigation would, appropriately enough, have to start at ground zero. They were just using a figure of speech, but we should return to ground zero. And remember that, of course, on 9/11, Jerome Hauer, H-A-U-E-R, got the White House on the anti-anthrax drug Cipro weeks before the anthrax mailing started. Of course, we've always known they were coming from the inside. We've always fingered a gentleman named Philip Zack as one of the main culprits. And as I said, I have massive anthrax updates that I won't get into right here, so we're going to jump a couple days later, flurry, 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 and then finally the Justice Department claims that the anthrax case is closed and that it was all Bruce Ivins.
A seven-year mystery solved.
We are confident that Dr. Ivins was the only person responsible for these attacks.
The government has released dozens of documents it says prove Army microbiologist Bruce Ivins was behind the 2001 anthrax attacks that killed five and chilled a nation. Among them, one alleging Ivins had sole custody of highly purified anthrax spores with certain genetic mutations identical to the poison from the attacks. Another saying he was not able to give a good enough explanation for late lab work hours around the time of the attacks, painting a picture of a deeply troubled genius bordering on desperation at being caught and who killed himself as authorities closed in.
We stand here today firmly convinced that we have a person who committed those attacks, and we are confident that had this gone to trial, we would have proved him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Before the government made the information public, it provided details to the victims' families, inviting them here to the FBI's headquarters, a long-awaited briefing for many who say they've been full of questions for years. The relatives spent several hours inside and left without speaking to reporters. New Jersey Congressman Chris Smith was in another Justice Department briefing on Capitol Hill.
It paints, I think, a very compelling picture. There's no airtight cases, but probably the most compelling part of the evidence stream is the issue of microbial forensics, where they were able to pinpoint that the anthrax that killed five people and wounded several others, injured several others, came from his lab. He created it, and he maintained it.
Ivins' lawyer has steadfastly maintained his client's innocence, saying it would have been proven if Ivins was still alive. The government says it regrets not having the chance to take the case to a jury. Sagar Meghani, The Associated Press, Washington.
So, I say the Justice Department falsely claims that the anthrax case is closed. The DPA, the Deutsche Press Agency, authorities declare 2001 anthrax case closed. The U.S. Justice Department Wednesday said it was convinced that a top government scientist who committed suicide last week was the sole person responsible for the deadly 2001 anthrax attacks that terrified the nation. Bruce Ivins was set to be indicted last week for the anthrax-laced mailings, sent only weeks after 9/11. The department earlier Wednesday unsealed hundreds of court documents it believed proved that Ivins had sent the letters. And there is a link there. You can hop over and you can read more about it. We believe that, based on the evidence we have collected, we could prove his guilt to a jury beyond reasonable doubt, said Jeffrey Taylor, U.S. Attorney for the District of Criminals. Now, of course, they don't have to prove his guilt to a jury beyond reasonable doubt because he's appropriately enough dead. And again, we'll get into this further on the next episode of MediaMonarchy.com, but also remember Operation Dark Winter. A lot of the same characters, a lot of the same scenarios played out in drills and exercises previously. And so I'm going to leave it there. The supposed lone anthrax gunman supposedly commits suicide. Let's shift gears yet again to another big story. This, of course, concerns the lies about Iraq and 9/11. And Ron Suskind and his new book. But first, the other bit that's in Ron Suskind's new book, The Way of the World. This is from thinkprogress.org. Bush White House has its own interrogation room. In Ron Suskind's new book, Suskind describes a disturbing case in D.C. where security officials detained and interrogated Usman Khosa. That's U-S-M-A-N. K-H-O-S-A, a Pakistani U.S. college graduate, because he was fiddling with his iPod near White House gates. Officials took Khosa to an interrogation room beneath the White House. And there's links there, and you can read more about the interrogation room within the White House, so Bush can be his own little Jack Bauer. But the other one, the more important one, Suskind defends charge that Bush faked Iraq link to 9/11. This from Raw Replay and NBC. Meredith Vieira talked with Ron Suskind about his new book, The Way of the World, that alleges the Bush White House ordered the CIA to create a fake letter linking Saddam Hussein to the 9/11 attacks.
Ron Suskind is the author of The Way of the World, a story of truth and hope in an age of extremism. Ron, good morning to you.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Your book is full of some very serious charges that the White House deliberately misled the American public. In the book, you call it one of the great lies in modern American political history, that it ignored intelligence from the chief of intelligence in Iraq, that there were no weapons of mass destruction. So how were you able to confirm all of these elements?
Well, you know, I've done this sort of thing for a while, and here the way it worked is there were off-the-record sources who laid out the story, and then I went to people actually involved. They were freed up because they're not the original source, if you will, to sort of talk about the context, what they felt, what they did, of people actually involved, and of course they're all through the book, on the record, talking about how it'll work.
But why are they willing to talk now, Ron?
Well, you know, a lot of them have been walking around with this lump in their chest for a couple of years, 5 years now, and because they're essentially free, they're not the source, the original source, they said, look, why hide now? Let's trust the truth.
You know, you talk about the smoking gun evidence that the White House tried to manipulate the intelligence, that it ignored this intelligence chief from Iraq, Bush. But they had a lot of information that they were gathering at the time, some of it contradicting what he was saying. So what convinced you that he was a more reliable source than anyone else?
Well, at this late date in this administration, people are finally saying, let's step up in sunlight. And I lay out step by step how there was really very little in the way of case, actually, at that point when Bush pops up in early January 2003 and says there are no W&D. And beyond that, Meredith, he went through in the meetings in January with the British intelligence chief. He went through the mind of Saddam Hussein, why he's acting the way he did, all the things that came out later.
Yeah, but you heard David Gregory to say the British intelligence eventually wrote him off, said he was not reliable.
No, that's not exactly the way it worked. And in the book, you'll see people who were involved in it talking about the debate. And it was quite a fierce debate at the very highest levels of the government about, is Habush reliable? What's he saying? How can we check it? And a lot of people at the end of the day said it was hard for him to prove the negative, that what he said were no weapons were actually not there. That's hard to do.
You know, you say that this is worse than Watergate in large part because of this letter that you claim the White House ordered the CIA to forge that would link Iraq with 9/11, Muhammad Atta, and with Al-Qaeda. And CIA agents that you quote in the book agree that there was a letter, but what has convinced you that the White House was behind it? What evidence do you have that the White House ordered it?
Well, the CIA folks involved in the book and others talk about George coming back, Tenet coming back from the White House with the assignment on White House stationery and turning to the CIA operatives who are professionals saying, you may not like this, but here's our next mission. And they carried it through step by step all the way to the finish. And ultimately, people even talked about it after the fact.
More bombshells, and yet, in a way, more limited hangout incompetence theory bullshit, but at least it gets it out to the masses. So even if we play the incompetence card, well, we didn't know that they would hijack planes. I didn't know that there wasn't yellow cake or any of that shit. In a way, even if we can get into the limited hangout stuff, it at least exposes the lies, and then there's a hand outstretched, and we can yank it down the rabbit hole. So in that link, and in that story, Raw Replay, you can also hit up Cryptagon and Politico and learn about the fake letter and Muhammad Atta. Shifting gears to the presidential selection campaign going on. This yesterday from the AP, a man held on charge of threatening to kill Obama. A man is being held in Florida by federal authorities on charges of threatening to assassinate Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama. Raymond Hunter Geisel, G-E-I-S-E-L, was ordered held without bail Thursday at a brief court hearing. Secret Service said Geisel made the threat during a training class for bail bondsmen in Miami in late July. Another tipster said Geisel also threatened President Bush. A search of Geisel's SUV and hotel room uncovered a loaded handgun, knives, dozens of rounds of ammunition, body armor, and a machete. The SUV was wired with emergency lights. Geisel told the Secret Service he was originally from Bangor, Maine. He contended he made no threat against either Obama or Bush. I'm sure we'll hear more about that, but there's links you can hit up. Transworldnews.com. Washington Times. You can run searches on Raymond Hunter Geisel as the news pours out about him. I'm sure we'll find interesting things out about him, or it'll just get swept under the rug. So the other one the leading light of the fake progressive Democratic Party that keeps betraying you again and again and again. But you'll keep lining up because there's a big D after their name. Let's jump over to our good friend Nancy Pelosi. Staying in Florida, appropriately enough, and the good folks at We Are Change Florida, wearechangefl.org. So this was on Nancy Pelosi's book tour at a stop in Coral Gables, Florida on August 6th, where she talks about the New World Order and explains how it's all written on the $1 bill in Novus Ordo Seclorum. It's a little tough to hear, but you can watch the video and you can see her talking about this grand experiment where wealthy slave-owning elites crafted a constitution that maybe doesn't include people like us, but they wrote it on there, and people like Pelosi know the game, they know the handshake, and they even throw some out there: Novus Ordo Seclorum, New World Order. Another big one. There's also a lot of trials going on while we're watching all the fanfare, dog and pony, Beijing Olympics, DNC, RNC conventions, and the terror drills and all those things we're going to get into. There's also a lot of trials and tribunals. So, driving Bin Laden, which we covered on the previous episode, Bin Laden driver seeks leniency from Gitmo jury. Osama Bin Laden's former driver is expected to ask the Pentagon jury that convicted him of a war crime to spare him to, or rather, to spare him from life in prison on Thursday. So he wants some leniency.
At the first U.S. war crimes trial since World War II, a panel of six officers delivered a split verdict on the trial of Osama bin Laden's driver, Salim Hamdan, finding him guilty of aiding terrorism, but acquitting him of two of the serious charges of conspiring to attack the U.S. Defense attorneys have long argued that trials are unfair and violate the Constitution, but Wednesday, his defense team applauded the jury's decision on the conspiracy charges.
I would have to think that given the case that was put on, it had to be an unwelcome development for the prosecution.
Hamdan's attorneys say before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the Bush administration's first attempt at the military tribunal system was unconstitutional, Hamdan faced conspiracy charges alone. But they say prosecutors then tacked on the aiding terrorism charges in the months after the Supreme Court's decision, when the Bush administration rewrote the rules.
The problem is that the law was specifically written after the fact to target Mr. Hamdan, and that's where you lose justice. If there was justice, Mr. Hamdan would have been completely acquitted.
Defense attorneys say now that he's been convicted, he will ask for leniency at a sentencing hearing set for Thursday. A spokesman at the White House is applauding what he called a fair trial and says prosecutors will now proceed with other war crimes trials in Guantanamo Bay. Brian Thomas, The Associated Press.
I hadn't caught that before, where they mention that bin Laden's driver, Hamdan, was pinned with conspiracy charges by himself, which is an oxymoron. Conspiracy, by its very definition, is at least two people conspiring. Takes two to tango. So we can look at some of the updates, and he was sentenced to about 5.5 years. So we can look at thinkprogress.org. Hamdan sentenced to 5.5 years in prison, though he may still be detained indefinitely. So he was convicted of supporting terrorism. We heard those charges were added later. That's from Wikinews. We've also got military.com and the Associated Press and McClatchy and the Washington Post and Raw Story and more. Some of the related items are things like U.S. let bin Laden's top bodyguard go. And you can hit that up from McClatchy. But we can also read that the bin Laden driver knew 9/11 target. This from Reuters. Osama bin Laden's, and actually we're jumping back to July 22nd while the trial was still going on. Osama bin Laden's driver knew the target of the fourth hijacked jetliner in the 9/11 attacks, a prosecutor said, in an attempt to draw a link between Hamdan and the al-Qaeda leadership in the first Guantanamo Wars trial. Hamdan's lawyer said in opening statements that the Yemeni held for nearly 7 years before his trial, was just a paid employee of the fugitive al-Qaeda leader, a driver in the motor pool who never joined the militant group or plotted attacks on America. But prosecutor Timothy Stone told the six-member jury of the U.S. military officers who decided Hamdan's 5.5-year guilt sentence that Hamdan had inside knowledge of the 2001 attacks on the United States because he overheard a conversation between bin Laden and al-Zawahiri. If they hadn't shot down the fourth plane, it would have hit the dome, Stone, a Navy officer, said in his opening remarks. If they hadn't shot down the fourth plane, it would have hit the dome. I didn't know we shot down the fourth plane. Has that been confirmed, Stone? Another one from Paul Craig Roberts, originally up on Counterpunch and all over the place. Do you feel safe now? Now that military officers selected by the Bush Pentagon have reached a split verdict convicting Salim Hamdan, a one-time driver for OBL, of supporting terrorism, but innocent of terrorist conspiracy, do you feel safe? Or are we superpower Americans still at risk until we capture bin Laden's dentist, barber, and the person who installed the carpet in his living room? The Bush regime, with its comic huffings and puffings, is unaware that it has made itself the laughingstock of the world, a comedy version of the Third Reich. Or is it fourth? Hamdan was not defended by the slick lawyers that got OJ off, and he most certainly did not have a jury of his peers. Hamdan was defended by a Pentagon-appointed U.S. Navy officer, and his jurors were all Pentagon-appointed U.S. military officers with an eye on their careers. Even in this kangaroo court, Hamdan was cleared of the main charge. And the article goes on, and Paul Craig Roberts asks if you feel like a proud American. And that's all there, and you can read it. We're going to shift gears yet again to a sad note, and I learned this from Heinrich over at the fantastic Red Ice Radio podcast, redicecreations.com, that Kent Daniel Benkowski of the Kentroversy Papers has passed away. So from redicecreations.com, we're very sad to announce that our good friend, researcher, and frequent guest on Red Ice Creations Radio, Kent Daniel Benkowski, or Kentroversy, has passed away. He died Wednesday, July 30th, 2008, in his home. He survived by his widow, Paula, son, Anthony, and his sister, Esther.
Hi there, this is Henrik Palmgren, and as you probably know from the headline of this article or announcement, we do have some sad news for you today. Our good friend, researcher, and frequent guest on our radio program, Kent Daniel Bentkowski, or Kentroversy, has passed away. He died last Wednesday, the 30th of July, 2008, in his home. He survived by his widow, Paula, his son, Anthony, and his sister, Esther. And I know that his wife, Paula, suggested that anyone who want to send a memorial should donate to Buffalo, New York, the U.S. area hospice care. And I actually got a call from Greg from occultofpersonality.com this past Monday, I think it was, and I was kind of shocked to hear the news.
So that's just a little quick recording from Heinrich, where in a few moments after that, he brings on Greg from A Cult of Personality, and they talk about the late Kent Daniel Bentkowski, and you can hit up a lot of his articles and interviews up on redicecreations.com. Shifting back to Police State USA, this from Reuters, judge says Denver can restrict protests at the convention. Protesters at the Democratic National Convention in Denver can be restricted to fenced-in areas. A federal judge ruled on Wednesday saying that security needs outweighed curbs on their rights. And you can hit up the New York Times and you can see nice photos of stormtroopers in black. A dozen groups who intend to protest at the August convention sued the Secret Service and the city of Denver over plans to confine their activities to a parade route and fenced-in zone. Remember, that's a free speech zone, saying that their constitutional rights to free speech were being violated. The ACLU and the American Friends Service Committee, that's AFSC.org, American Friends Service Committee, and others argued that the rules would keep them too far away from the downtown Pepsi Center. And of course, the convention is going on August 25th through the 28th. U.S. District Judge Marcia Krieger, K-R-I-E-G-E-R, agreed that the protesters would suffer some infringement on their freedom of expression, but said that those interests had to be balanced with security concerns, saying, quote, "The restrictions inhibit the plaintiff's ability to engage in some form of expressive conduct, but the plaintiffs have a wide variety of alternative means of expression that will allow them to effectively communicate their messages," end quote. And that's from Krieger's 71-page ruling, which I could not find a link to just yet. If you got it, leave a comment on that. Dovetailing with that, however, from the 9/11 truth-censoring Huffington Post, National Guard rents 500-plus hotel rooms for the DNC. The U.S. Army and Colorado National Guard have announced intentions to reserve more than 500 hotel rooms for lodging during the DNC, hinting at the number of military personnel that may be in Denver for the high-profile event that is expected to draw an estimated 50,000 protesters. While the Democratic Convention is being held August 25th through the 28th, officials with the Colorado National Guard are seeking to reserve 438 rooms for the 22nd to the 30th and 78 rooms for the 18th through the 30th, according to award announcements published Friday on the Federal Business Opportunities website, FBO.gov, a page run by the federal government for business contract solicitations. The documents show that the majority of the Guard personnel staying are set to lodge at Johnson & Wales University on 7150 Mount View Boulevard in Far East Denver, while 32 rooms will be rented out for an unknown Extended Stay America location in Denver. So they're spilling out all over the place. And I believe in a little bit we'll hit up about all the drills that they're running, which we've hit before, but we'll hit it again. And oh, speaking of drills, FEMA suspends Top Off 5. SAIC drops out of competition. Now, doing the show here in Portland, we've covered the Top Off terror drills, T-O-P-O-F-F. Last fall, we had Top Off 4 here in Portland, Oregon. SAIC was involved in it. Now, previously, we noted that SAIC was investigated for conflict of interest. That was just 2 weeks ago. Now, more has come out. This from Washington Technology. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has suspended a procurement for the upcoming top officials, Top Off 5, national disaster drill to investigate allegations of improprieties in the contracting process, said FEMA Administrator R. David Paulison. Also, Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC, said it has withdrawn its bid on the Top Off 5 contract and has put several employees on administrative leave while it conducts a review of the allegations, saying, quote, "We are receiving the situation but we withdrew our proposal because we want to assure the government of our intention to perform in a completely ethical manner. SEIC said that in a statement released by Laura Luke, one of their spokespeople. Now, when you post stories about SAIC and FEMA and Top Off and terror drills, you get lots of visits from them. SAIC has been all over MediaMonarchy.com reading about their conflict of interest, and hopefully some of the employees will hit some of the links in those stories and learn about terror drills. And we'll get into some of their visits at the end of the episode. And again, there's a lot of links in there, and you can read all about our good friends in the private military contracting and intelligence biz. But we're going to jump again, and there's been a lot of these. I think I only posted a couple in the last couple weeks, but there's a massive amount. There's always a massive amount. It's basically seeming like at some point, whether implicitly or explicitly, that the federalized police have been told to go nuts with tasering. So, just one example, in the last few days, Pennsylvania police investigating death of tased man. Allegheny County police in Pennsylvania are investigating the death of a man who was shocked with a taser. Police said that a taser was used after the man refused to follow orders and made furtive movements towards others.
Police are investigating an incident where a man died after he was hit by a taser gun by local police. Allison Morris is live with the story. Allison.
Yeah, Christine, Allegheny County police are continuing to investigate this case. They say that just about midnight last night, police received multiple calls that a man was running around Hawthorne Avenue in Swissvale behaving erratically. They say he had actually tried to enter several homes in the 2200 block of Hawthorne Avenue. Witnesses believe that the man came down from the flats. They say that he was screaming that police were trying to shoot and kill him, and that's when one of the Swissvale police officers pulled out a taser.
He was like yelling and screaming and acting really erratically, and they didn't know what the situation was. So they asked him just to calm down and so forth, and he made a movement toward them, and so they had to tase him.
After he was tased, emergency medical workers treated the man on the scene right on the sidewalk by the intersection of Hawthorne and Roslyn. Police tell us that he was conscious after workers treated him, that he was sent to a local hospital, Braddock Hospital specifically, but he was pronounced dead there. We're not sure exactly what happened between leaving the scene and heading to the hospital. The medical examiner right now is not confirming this man's identity. All we know is that he is 37 years old. They say they do know who he is, but they're waiting to notify his family, and they will be performing an autopsy to try to better understand the cause of his death. For now, reporting live outside of Allegheny County Police Headquarters in Point Breeze, Allison Morris, KDKA TV News.
So that's just one example, just one recent example. And if we hit up a little more in there, KDKA reported, quote, but witnesses we spoke with say what happens after he was tased was unnecessary. One woman who declined to be identified said, quote, after he was tased and handcuffed, one officer used a football-type kick and stomped him in the head. The man's father told WXPI, I want to know what happened, what the particulars of the incident were that caused my son's death. And there's links in there, and you can, of course, read about militarized police tasing all of us to death. If we jump to Reuters, Pentagon closes controversial intelligence unit. The Pentagon last Monday said it was closing a controversial intelligence office that had raised concerns about domestic spying by the military after 9/11. And of course, we know they've been spying long before 9/11. And a lot of times, when they close something, when they close a door, they open a window, close one down, change its name, pop it over to somewhere else, whether it's total information awareness or echelon or carnivore, God knows whatever it is, you know they're doing it. The Defense Department said it had disassembled the Counterintelligence Field Activity Office, or CIFA, CIFA. And you can hit up CIFA.mil, and nothing comes up. But it was created in February 2002 by former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to manage defense and armed service efforts against the intel threats from foreign powers and groups such as Al-Qaeda. Or peace groups or, you know, death penalty opponent protesters or things like that. Those responsibilities will now be carried out by a new organization called the Defense Counterintelligence and Human Intelligence Center, overseen by the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency. So, CIFA closed, and now the DIA is running DCHIC. You should just check out Puzzle Palace by James Bamford and learn about the history of our secret intelligence that, of course, starts in peacetime, morphs into something else in wartime, then morphs into something else yet again after it needs to go away for peacetime again. But last night, here in Portland, there was the premiere of the film The Reflecting Pool. It was at the Hollywood Theater last night, and actually, the writer-director Jarek Kupczyk, KUPSC, and producer and actor Joseph Culp were both present for a Q&A afterwards. They were also on KBOO yesterday morning. There's links in there for you. You can listen to that interview. You can watch trailers and clips from the film The Reflecting Pool. I really should have gone, but I didn't. But I at least posted it on the website, and hopefully people heard the interview on KBOO and went and checked it out. Of course, our snotty local press said, oh, yay, the truthers made a movie. Never, of course, taking time to actually look into any of it, but anyway. Let's take a little trip down memory lane to thinkprogress.org and celebrate another fantastic anniversary. Wednesday was the 7th anniversary of the famed August 6th PDB Bin Laden determined to strike inside U.S. So we know that Bush received it. There's the photos of him receiving it with his little shady Harriet Myers. And he was, of course, reported to say, I believe it was in this case, well, you covered your ass. And you can download the PDF and read it. At the time, Bush was vacationing at his ranch in Crawford, Texas, and stayed on vacation the rest of August. So here's how the administration reacted, according to the 9/11 Whitewash Commission. President Bush did not recall discussing the August 6th report with the Attorney General or whether Rice had done so. That's on page 260. We have found no indication of any further discussion before 9/11 among the president and his top advisors of the possibility of a threat of an al-Qaeda attack in the United States. DCI Tenet visited Bush in Crawford on August 17th and participated in the PDB briefings of the president between August 31st, after the president had returned to Washington, and September 10th. But Tenet does not recall any discussions with the president of the domestic threat during this period. That's page 262 from the 9/11 Whitewash Commission. But returning to Think Progress, the day after he received the memo, quote, Bush seemed carefree as he spoke about the books he was reading, the work he was doing on his nearby ranch, his love of hot weather jogging, his golf game, and his 55th birthday. That's a quote from the Washington Post. So, Wednesday, August 6, 2008, 2,557 days later, Bin Laden remains free and determined to strike in U.S. That's, of course, the lefty Think Progress take. The crazy media monarchy take is that he's a corpse and they will roll him out when necessary, possibly soon. But I now see, as I glance to the little clock in the top right corner of the screen, that we're into hour number 2 of episode 86 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's 888, August 8th, 2008. Coming to you live, as always, every Friday morning at 10 Pacific Time from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time on revereradionetwork.com, revereradio.info. And also thanks to 95.3 KBFR in Boulder and 87.9 Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta for rebroadcasting the show that you can get from iTunes and RadioForAll.net and Archive.org. And of course, all the email and social networking and video and IM and all that good stuff, Media Monarchy is your keyword. So, I believe it's how we started the first hour, but let's do it again. Loosen things up a little bit. Pentagon's unmanned spokes drone completes its first press conference mission.
This newly developed unmanned Pentagon spokes drone completed its first live mission today, successfully carrying out a press conference on the war in Iraq. The mobile press engagement unit, which is capable of answering reporters' questions while being controlled from a bunker miles away, is being hailed by Pentagon officials as a revolutionary advancement in protecting military personnel.
Will more American troops be called to assist in the protection of these new Iraqi officials?
I'm not going to start to speculate on future developments, Nancy. Yes, Bill.
Commander Cameron Kennedy oversaw the debut mission.
The spokes drone proved effective at neutralizing reporters' questions about 85% of the time.
Documents obtained by the Onion News Network show the Pentagon spent over $45 million developing the spokes drone, but many officials say the unit has the potential to save countless careers. Using a high-tech gimbal camera and microphone system, the unit tracks reporters' movements and audio output, then analyzes the data to assess the threat level.
The satellite link-up transmits data up to an orbiting satellite, and it formulates and deploys an effectively vague response.
We have taken away a number of the enemy sanctuaries and gained initiatives in the areas. Eileen.
Military technology experts see the unit as adaptable to a wide variety of treacherous interview scenarios. They estimated it could even withstand situations too hostile for any human spokesman to bear, such as anti-war documentary interviews.
It's also capable of serving jail time.
As a final failsafe, the spokes drone can self-destruct if a line of questioning becomes too dangerous, incinerating the unit and any press corps within a 200-foot radius.
Pentagon's unmanned spokes drone completes its first press conference mission. From the Onion News Network, the spokes drone will field questions deemed too dangerous for a human press secretary whose career could be irreparably damaged by answering them. Or, of course, they can come out later with a book and saying, oh, yeah, we were lying. Sorry. Yeah, thanks a lot, McClellan. And thanks a lot, Onion. But let's get into our crumbling economy for a moment. Attacks on all fronts, whether it's what's in your wallet or what isn't in your wallet. What's going down your gullet, what you're breathing, what you're reading, what you're seeing, what you're believing. Attacks on all fronts. But this from Reuters. NYU professor Noriel Roubini, and that's R-O-U-B-I-N-I, NYU prof Noriel Roubini says hundreds of banks will fail. The U.S. is in the second inning of a recession that will last for at least 18 months and help kill off hundreds of banks. Influential economist and NYU prof Noriel Roubini told Barron's in the Sunday edition. And there's links there, and you can read and even see a little quick interview up on RGEmonitor.com. Taxpayers will pay a big price for helping bail out the rest of the financial services industry as well, Roubini said. At least $1 trillion, and more likely $2 trillion. The banks will become insolvent because of mounting losses as a result of housing bust and because they have only written down their subprime loans so far, write-downs. Still in front of them are their consumer credit losses for which they lack the reserves, Barron's reported. He also said there are hundreds of millions of dollars outstanding in home equity loans that could well be worth zero. So the fraudulent fiat money system and speculations and private equity and venture capitalists. All you gotta know is they loan out 10 for every one. That's why they don't have the reserves. That's why when you line up at Indy Bank and say, where's my money? And you go, why don't you have my money? I gave it to you. They don't have it. I won't go down the whole fraudulent Federal Reserve road because there's more to go over. Being away for a couple weeks again, there's lots of episodes of some of my favorite alternative media out there. And so there are new episodes from Outside the Box and my man Richard Andrew Grove over at 8thEstate.com. And we'll get into those later. But there's also some from Collateral News. They're up on YouTube.com/Collateral News, but they also now have launched CollateralNews.tv. But they have episodes 51, 52, and 53. 51, I'm not going to play. It's a rerun from an older episode. It's called Courting Disaster. If there's another Katrina-like disaster, says John McCain, he'll use the private sector as a model to make sure emergency supplies get where they're needed. So why not privatize disaster relief altogether, John? And that's the question Collateral News Episode 51 asks in Courting Disaster. However, we are going to listen to a little bit of Episode 52 and 53. They fit together, and it's still about the crumbling economy. So 52 is stealing the future every day, and Episode 53 is untaxed to death.
The economic news is bad, but since one of the primary jobs of the financial media is to keep us focused on the crisis of the week and keep our eyes off the big picture, no one on TV is saying just how bad the situation is. But among economic observers who aren't bought, paid for, there's a growing consensus that we're headed for a convulsion that hasn't been seen since the Great Depression, or perhaps ever. Welcome to Collateral.
Today I spoke with members of my economic team. They updated me on the state of our economy.
Constant stream of lies coming out of Washington about the state of the economy should be all you need to know about the trouble that's coming. The housing bill that's being pushed through Congress is the latest example. It's supposed to help ordinary people, but debt-ridden homeowners won't get any money directly. As noted by the Automatic Earth, it's banks who will get the money. People won't get a single discretionary dollar. Some homeowners will get temporary relief from their onerous mortgages. But they're still going to have to repay new loans, and those new loans are going to be based on overinflated home values. That's not likely to help in the long run.
It's clear our economy is slowed, but the good news is we anticipated this and took decisive action to bolster the economy.
It's a tangled economic web being weaved in Washington, as fear about the economy has become the excuse for a developing swindle of historic proportions. Congress just rushed through the housing bill, which should have been called the hosing bill, since it could cost U.S. taxpayers hundreds of billions of dollars. And according to a prominent economist, the next crisis looming, which is intimately connected to the housing calamity, may be the inability to pay hundreds of billions of dollars in pensions to state and local employees. Welcome to Collateral.
It may not seem important to you, but it is important.
What?
Yes, and it's your privilege, not just your duty, but your privilege to help your government by paying your tax and paying it promptly.
What's the big hurry?
David, there's an assumption in your question that is not necessarily correct. Sort of the democratic liberal assumption. I need money, I raise taxes.
Then what are you going to cut? What do you cut?
Wait. Let me explain it. The way to do it sometimes is reduce taxes and raise more money.
The esteemed economist Michael Hudson has weighed in on the housing bill, and his assessment of it squares with those who see it as a flat giveaway to mortgage houses and banks. Its purpose is to keep home prices artificially high in order to protect the collateral valuations for the loans that were packaged and sold to a variety of holders including international banks and pension funds. Essentially, these companies made big bets in the bundled mortgage securities market and lost. But with the bailout, they won't come out the losers they should be. It's blatant theft from you and me, and no one in Washington's risking a peep about it. The fair remedy would be to let housing prices fall to their proper level and let new buyers come in at fair valuations. That's what a capitalist remedy would be. But it's funny how when that process is going to hurt the big boys, politicians in Washington are happy to shun capitalism and socialize their losses.
The banksters are burning down the bar like Joe Pesci and Goodfellas. Whether it's the Federal Reserve or the Plunge Protection Team, they're going to pull it. And America's for sale. Jumping overseas, and this is how I began the show with a quote, "A state of war only serves as an excuse for domestic tyranny." That was said by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and he has passed away at the age of 89. So if we hit up the Associated Press, writer who shone light on the gulag dies, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Nobel Prize-winning author whose books chronicle the horrors of the Soviet gulag system, has died at 89. Son Stepan said his father died of heart failure. Solzhenitsyn's unflinching accounts of torment and survival in the Soviet Union's slave labor camps riveted his countrymen, whose secret history he exposed. It earned him 20 years of bitter exile, but international renown, and inspired millions. Beginning with the 1962 short novel One Day in the Life of Ivan Dzinovich, about a carpenter struggling to survive a Soviet labor camp, Solzhenitsyn described the human meat grinder that had caught him and millions of other Soviet citizens. Capricious arrests, often for trifling and absurd reasons, followed by slave labor camps where cold, starvation, and punishing work crushed a person.
The iconic Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn has died at the age of 89. The Nobel Prize winner in literature and a dissident passed away in Moscow after a stroke. Well, the Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has expressed condolences to the writer's widow and sons. Messages of sympathy have also come from U.S. President George Bush and France's Nicolas Sarkozy. Solzhenitsyn's books were the first to tell millions about the Soviet prison system and Joseph Stalin's repressions. He was expelled from the Soviet Union in 1974, but returned to Russia in the 90s. Archie looks back on his life.
This man shapes history with his writing. In his life, he has seen fame and persecution, popularity and years of exile. Alexander Solzhenitsyn served as captain of artillery during the Second World War. Just before its end, the 26-year-old man was arrested for criticizing Stalin in a letter to a friend. He was sent to a labor camp for 8 years. His double degree in mathematics and physics saved him from manual work during some of this time. He was placed in a specialized Moscow jail, which employed scientists and research. With Stalin's death in 1953 came Solzhenitsyn's release from prison, but not freedom. He was sent into permanent exile to Kazakhstan, where he worked as a teacher and wrote in secret. Political censorship was liberalized when Nikita Khrushchev condemned the cult of Stalin's personality. In 1962, Solzhenitsyn's short novel One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich brought him world recognition. The novel, showing the horrors of a day in a labor camp, was the first to tell millions of readers about the tragedy of Stalin's repressions.
Please let the world know about the horrors of Stalinist regime. And even though he was writing in a rather old-fashioned way, he was always writing freely, and he was always saying what he was thinking.
Khrushchev's downfall saw a new wave of persecution against the writer and eventually censorship on all his books. Solzhenitsyn's Nobel Prize for Literature in 1970 was denounced by the Soviet government as a politically hostile act. His unpublished manuscripts were smuggled into the West, securing his fame as an opponent of government policies. The confrontation grew more intense after publication abroad of his novels The First Circle and The Cancer Ward. And later, The Gulag Archipelago, the most powerful and detailed account of the Soviet prison system and secret police. The book had a strong international response, but angered Soviet authorities.
He told us in a clear way what our history from 1917, probably until the present, actually is. He was courageous enough to tell us in full about the monstrous Soviet system. The Gulag Archipelago was the keyword, a beacon that guided us to a new human way of life.
Rest in peace, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And there's all the links you can hit up, Guardian, BBC, Telegraph, Washington Post, and more, to read about the man and his work. Back to the homeland. Another story about Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. What the hell is going on there? So we've had the loose nukes fly out of Minot. We had them failing inspection tests and others. And now, two more stories, a week apart. Nuclear missile crew fell asleep on duty. CNN's Barbara Starr reported that the Air Force said that a crew in charge of outdated nuclear missile launch codes fell asleep while on duty. The Air Force Times also reported three missile officers with the 91st Space Wing at Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, fell asleep July 12th while holding a classified launch code device used to activate the missile control system. And there's a link to The Guardian for more on that. The device, kept in a locked case, installs the codes that allow the launch control center on base to command the intercontinental ballistic missiles in the missile silos.
Just coming into the Situation Room right now, we're getting word of a disturbing incident involving U.S. nuclear missiles. The U.S. Air Force says three of its people fell asleep while at the controls. It's the latest in a series of military nuclear-related blunders. Let's get the specific details from our Pentagon correspondent, Barbara Starr. What are you picking up, Barbara?
Well, what can you say except this does bring a new meaning to the phrase asleep at the switch. The Air Force now acknowledging that a nuclear missile launch crew fell asleep on July 12th while in control of electronic parts that contained old nuclear missile launch codes. It happened at a facility near Minot, North Dakota Air Force Base, a site for the Minuteman III nuclear missile. This crew can control up to 10 missiles under normal procedures. Here's what the Air Force says happened. The crew was behind locked doors, guarded by armed military personnel. The equipment was in a locked container. The codes were out of date and not usable, but three of the four crew members fell asleep, and that's not a good thing, to say the least. This is the fourth incident in recent months. You'll recall that nuclear warheads were flown across the country from Minot, North Dakota, to Barksdale, Louisiana. Nobody knew those warheads were on board. Fuses accidentally sent to Taiwan. A unit failed its nuclear security inspection in the Air Force. This latest matter now under investigation by the super secret National Security Agency, which actually creates those nuclear launch codes, and Air Force commanders are deciding on discipline for the crew.
Discipline for the crew, but what about the higher-ups? Is there going to be any look at maybe some of their bosses?
Well, one can only imagine. And again, you know, it's the fourth incident. Defense Secretary Robert Gates already fired the previous Air Force Secretary and the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, and it had there been many reviews now of the Air Force's nuclear security program, and this is now the fourth incident. They keep saying that the material is always under their control. There's never been a risk to national security, but to say the least, things are loose in terms of some of the procedures and regulations for the world's most secure or supposedly secure weapons arsenal.
I can only imagine the Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, how he's reacting to this, and I'm sure you can imagine as well. Barbara, thanks very much. What a story.
But why stop at four? Let's have a fifth one. This from the Associated Press. North Dakota towns unfazed by ICBM rocket. There's plenty to talk about at the weekly women's coffee clatch in the small town of Parshall, and no one bothered to mention the unarmed booster rocket for an intercontinental ballistic missile lying in a ditch where an Air Force truck overturned. We talked about the oil boom, weddings, everything under the sun, Arlene Zacher said Saturday, but nobody ever mentioned that missile. I guess that shows that people aren't worried about it. I'm certainly not. The Air Force said a truck carrying the booster for a Minuteman III overturned last Thursday a few miles east of Parshall in northwest North Dakota, but there was no danger to the public. The truck and booster rocket, which is 66 feet long and weighs 75,000 pounds, were still standing along the road the Saturday, although under armed guard. The scene is still in the assessment phase, said Major Lori A. Areño, an Air Force spokeswoman. It's still on its side in the ditch. Using technical terminology, Areo or Arellano said the wreck would stay there for at least a few more days. It has to be 100% stable for movement. It's not a quick process. We have to make sure everything is stable first. The truck was traveling from, of course, Minot Air Force Base to a launch facility in northwestern North Dakota when it crashed on the gravel road between Parshall and Makoti, about 70 miles from the airbase. Two airmen in the vehicle were not seriously injured. Zacher said residents of Parshall, a town of about 1,000 people, are used to missiles being transported in the area, and they trust the Air Force. If there's a problem, they'll take care of it, she said. They do a very good job. In Makoti, a farming community of about 145 people, Darwin Quant said he wasn't worried. They're moving them things around all the time, so we're used to it. As long as it ain't going off, we're okay. And if it did, it wouldn't matter anyway. So Darwin is chilling, and so is Arlene. But that's the fifth incident, and I had forgotten, as Barbara Starr in the clip mentioned, It was the loose nukes to Barksdale, the fuses to Taiwan, failing the inspection, falling asleep with the launch codes, and missiles and wrecked trucks laying on the side of the road. So again, tie this all in with the incompetence theory, whether it's biolabs or military bases, they're setting the stage for whoops. You know, I don't get into much ufology. However, there's a lot swirling around the Phoenix Mars lander and a lot of chatter about whether it's toxic substances or, in this case, the, quote, potential for life. This from UniverseToday.com. White House briefed for potential for life on Mars. It would appear that the U.S. president has been briefed by Phoenix scientists about the discovery of something more provocative than the discovery of water existing on the Martian surface. This news comes just as Thermal and Evolved Gas Analyzer, TEGA, confirmed experimental evidence for the existence of water in the Mars regolith. Whilst NASA scientists are not claiming that life once existed on the red planet's surface, new data appears to indicate the potential for life more conclusively than the TEGA water results. Apparently, these new results are being kept under wraps until further, more detailed analysis can be carried out, but we are assured that this announcement will be huge. So why is there all this secrecy? According to scientists incommunicado with Aviation Week and Space Technology, the next big discovery will need to be mulled over for a while before it is announced to the world. Now, I have an update that I won't hit right here, but I believe is that NASA denies these reports. There's no potential for life, nothing to see here. If we jump to an article from William F. Engdahl over on globalresearch.ca, he of course wrote Seeds of Destruction and writes lots of great articles on global research. This one is the real state of the U.S. economy. When Henry Paulson agreed to leave his job as chairman of the powerful Wall Street investment bank Goldman Sachs, who is of course the biggest funder of Brzezinski's puppet Barack Obama. But when Paulson quit his job at Goldman Sachs to go to Washington as Treasury Secretary in 06, he demanded extraordinary powers as de facto economic czar, and he got it. Paulson is also the head of the President's Working Group on Financial Markets, the Plunge Protection Team. The Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. The Plunge Protection Team, PPT, is the financial world's equivalent of the Pentagon War Room. Paulson, not the Fed chairman, is perhaps calling the shots. That article from Engdahl goes on. But I believe I chopped it off, however. What I wanted to read in that article is a big long list of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of store closings of a lot of stores that you recognize. So that's all in that posting, the real state of the U.S. economy. There's a quick little... Oh, wait. No, I got it. Bear with me. Sorry here. We got Ann Taylor closing 117, Eddie Bauer, Cash, Lane Bryant, Talbots, Gap, Foot Locker, Wix, Levitt's, Zales, Disney Store, Home Depot, CompUSA, Macy's, Movie Gallery, Pep Boys, Sprint, Nextel, JCPenney, Lowe's and Office Depot, Ethan Allen, Wilson, The Leather Experts, Bombay Company, KB Toys, Dillard's Incorporated, and on and on and on. They're all closing an unprecedented amount of stores. And so the article says that Paulson, not Bernanke, is the person running the administration's crisis management. So just another example of our fake economy crumbling. But has it gotten too big for the globalists to even get out of it? There's a quick cartoon posted up. How long have you been a Democrat? Shows a woman sitting in the eye doctor's office. The chart is up on the wall. And the doctor says, "You're myopic, unable to focus, and you can't read the writing on the wall. How long have you been a Democrat?" I think I got that from my man James at total411.info, but I can't remember. But remember, the Democrats, you know, that we voted in 06, you know, impeach and end the war and all that. Yeah. If we jump to the Washington Post, Bush centralizes control of intelligence agencies, with the addendum that, of course, the police state agenda marches onward. The Washington Post did not include that in the title of this article. However, the Bush administration unveiled new operating guidelines for the nation's intelligence community in a move that boosted the authority of the DNI, who we mentioned, of course, now took over where CIFA left off. And, of course, it triggers protests from lawmakers who complained that they weren't properly consulted. Not that it's wrong or secret and fucked up, but you didn't tell us about it. The changes affirmed the DNI's role as the head of 16 U.S. spy agencies and expanded its powers to set priorities and coordinate the sharing of intel. The DNI also was given an expanded role in foreign intelligence collection and in the hiring and firing of senior intelligence officials. The changes were part of a long-awaited overhaul of Executive Order 12333 EO-12333. There's a link. You can read about its history up on whitehouse.gov, and you can see the changes that they're proposing. But it was a Reagan-era document that establishes the powers and responsibilities of the intelligence services. Most of the revisions merely reflect changes already in place since the DNI was established by Congress 3 years ago, partly as a response to, of course, 9/11. The blank check that let them do everything. Returning to the story of the strange fire at Rick Perry's governor's mansion in Texas. So we hit up a few weeks ago the strange case of the governor's mansion fire. The update now from the New York Times: firebombing leads to finger pointing, but not at suspect. It's been nearly 8 weeks since someone tossed a Molotov cocktail over the wall of the governor's mansion. And the Texas Rangers seem no closer to finding the culprit than they did on the day of the fire, which gutted the historic landmark. Indeed, the whole episode is beginning to be an embarrassment to the state police, and more specifically to the Texas Rangers, who see themselves as something akin to Scotland Yard, except on horseback. Finger-pointing is rampant. A longtime director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, Colonel Thomas A. Davis, Jr., resigned a week after the fire under heavy criticism from a citizens' commission that oversees his department. Then officials this last week made public an internal state police report showing that security at the mansion, which was unoccupied and undergoing renovations when the fire broke out, was inadequate to say the least. "It really was the gang that couldn't shoot straight," said Harvey Kronberg, a columnist and the owner of the Quorum Report, quorumreport.com, an online journal that chronicles the Texas Capitol's doings. There's a little video of a supposed suspect walking by. It's about 7 seconds long. You can check it out. But you just hear some of those things that just ring so familiar. Like the fire and destruction happened at a place where there were renovations. Like at the Pentagon. But if we jump to the Philadelphia Inquirer, a nice story about our good friends at the CPS and others. It's not just them. Philly social workers starve 14-year-old girl to death. Two Philadelphia social workers were among nine charged in the death of Danielle Kelly, D-A-N-I-E-A-L, K-E-L-L-Y, 14-year-old girl who starved to death in 2006, her body eaten by bed sores to the bone. Unveiling a blistering grand jury report with a link for you to the PDF, District Attorney Lynn Abraham blasted the city's Department of Human Services as an indifferent and callous agency that had let Kelly die needlessly. Drawing gasps at a news conference in which she showed a photograph of Kelly's bloody, emaciated corpse, Abraham urged the state to take over DHS, a call that was not embraced by state officials. At a later news conference, agency director Anne Marie Ambrose broke down crying at the podium when asked if she had seen the photo in which the dead child was hardly recognizable as a human. The grand jury's stark and emotionally wrenching report, Abraham said, should outrage the whole Philadelphia community. And of course, that's just one case. Now you know how, of course, the tabloids and tabloid news, they'll trumpet whatever blonde white girl goes missing, but we know far more little black kids in places like Florida go missing in the DHS. Tons of them. If you just Google Florida CPS death, you won't be happy. Jumping back to thinkprogress.org, this is a fun one. Anything that involves the Bush crime family and our man Rush Limbaugh is always bound to be interesting. Here's another great Bush foot-in-mouth moment, but it's also, of course, very telling. But thinkprogress.org has Limbaugh marks 20 years on the air with a call from Poppy Bush and the Bush crime family. Conservative radio talker Rush Limbaugh marks 20 years on the air. That was Friday, August 1st. And during that show, Limbaugh received a call from the President, George W. Bush, former President George H.W. Bush, and former Governor of Florida, Jeb Bush. The Bush family congratulated their pal Limbaugh on his 20 years of important and excellent broadcasting. However, something funny happened when old Poppy Bush got on the line.
What? What do you interrupt for? What?
Hello.
Oh, geez. The President.
Rush Limbaugh?
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
President George W. Bush calling to congratulate you on 20 years of important and excellent broadcasting.
Well, thank you, sir. You stunned me. I'm shocked. Thank
That's
you so much.
That's hard to do.
No, I just...
I'm here with a room full of admirers. There's two others that would like to speak to you and congratulate you. People who consider you friends and really appreciate the contribution you've made.
Thank you, sir, very much. Put them on.
Hey, Rush.
Mr. President, sir.
How are you doing?
I'm never better. I am so glad that you three called me. I'm stunned here. It's great to hear from you. It's a
well,
time.
Wonderful. I got some advice for you.
Tell me.
Slow down your backswing. That's all I'm doing is giving advice. We're playing with you and enjoying it. And how are you?
I'm great.
Proud of you.
I'm
always.
Well, thank you. No, I'm doing great. And you looking well too.
Well, yeah, I'm so kind of on the sidelines, but I can't do golf and all that stuff anymore. But it's lots is good. It's wonderful, and it's great having the family up here in Maine, and all is well. Do you see our man Ailes at all?
Oh yeah, I saw Roger at Tony Snow's funeral.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and a couple of times earlier this summer. He's
are we on the radio? Are we? I didn't know that. I've cleaned up my act here. I'm really telling me.
Yeah, we're on the radio. You know.
Well, it's wonderful talking to you, I'll tell you.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, Poppy. So senile, he slipped up on the air talking to Limbaugh on his 20th anniversary and said, "Do you see our man Ailes?" And if you don't know, he's talking about Roger Ailes, the president of Fox News. As we've told you time and time again, Roger Ailes, Rupert Murdoch, Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, the Bush crime family, the Clinton crime family, they're all good buddies. So there you have Poppy Bush slipping up on the air. And then I believe after that, good old Jeb Bush gets on the line as well. But we're going to move forward. And another trial falling apart. And as we've said, you know, when these big events, the big terror events and these big things happen, they're all over page A1. But as the stories fall apart in the ensuing weeks, the stories get to B2 and H12. Or just not printed at all. So they don't tell you that it's all phony. That was one thing that, of course, extremely pissed me off in the airport. But you can't talk about it there. They'll bundle me off. About the liquids. The phony fucking liquid bombing plot from the UK still affects us in this country, that they take old women's bottles of water or dump my girlfriend's shampoo. That case was phony, trumped-up bullshit from guys that didn't have passports, didn't have plane tickets, and they were provocateured by informants. And yet, still, we have to dump out our liquids. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm digressing. Let's look at the 7-7 Patsy trial. We, of course, a few weeks ago had the anniversary of the London 7-7 terror bombings. But this from the BBC: jury dismissed in 7-7 plot trial. The jury in the trial of three men accused of helping the 7-7 bombers has failed to reach a verdict. The Kingston Crown Court jury had spent 3 weeks considering a charge of conspiracy to cause an explosion. And there's a link in there to the Daily Mail. And of course, you know, they'll go for double or triple jeopardy, whatever they can. Or they'll quietly toss the charges and you won't hear about it. But another one about 7-7 from the Daily Mail: lost MI5 facts could have stopped 7-7. A chance to stop the 7-7 bombers may have been missed when a Secret Service fax to police went missing. A damning report is expected to reveal that the MI5 document sent to West Yorkshire police raised suspicions about ringleader Mohammed Sadiq Khan and his accomplice Shehzad Tanweer. And then, finally, under the heading "Jury Dismissed in 7-7 Patsy Trial," you can hit the flashback to the complete 9/11 timeline or the History Commons. Nothing but documented news. Doesn't draw the conclusions, but it's all there in all its contradictory glory. 7-7 bombings were simultaneous with terrorism exercise, reveals security consultant Peter Power. I don't know if I've played that clip for you, but you've probably heard it that, of course, Peter Power and Visor Consultants went on the BBC the day of 7-7 and said, "Oh, we just happen to be running a drill of the exact same buses and trains blowing up in the exact same times and places. It was just a coincidence." That's why we watch the drills. Another bombshell. Another explosive development. ThinkProgress.org has it. Paul Joseph Watson has some more about it, and we'll also hear a clip from Olbermann. But it's another false flag operation exposed. Dress up Navy SEALs like Iranians and shoot at them. Now, of course, they would never do something like 9/11, though. But from thinkprogress.org, speaking at the Campus Progress Journalism Conference earlier this month, Seymour Hersh, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for The New Yorker, revealed that Bush administration officials held a meeting recently in the vice president's office to discuss ways to provoke a war with Iran. In Hearst's most recent article, he reports that this meeting occurred in the wake of the overblown incident in the Strait of Hormuz when a U.S. carrier almost shot at a few small Iranian speedboats. Remember the "I am coming at you"? The meeting took place in the vice president's office. The subject was how to create a casus belli between Tehran and Washington, according to one of Hersh's sources. And there is the clip, and you can read about Hersh, or rather listen and see Hersh talking about Cheney and his idea of a false flag operation of dressing up Navy SEALs like Iranians. But the next one is from Steve Watson, actually. Media blackout on Cheney Iran false flag story. The mainstream American corporate press has once again proven itself to be no better than the state-controlled media in places like China or Zimbabwe by steadfastly refusing to print even a mention of the huge story concerning Hersh's recent comments that the vice president wanted to carry out a false flag op to provoke a war with Iran. Given that only a few weeks ago, Hersh's exclusive story concerning the vamping up of covert U.S. military activity inside Iran made headlines everywhere, in every major publication and outlet, it begs the question, where are they now for an even bigger story? The Financial Times even carries a story today about how Hersh is the last great American reporter, yet the lengthy piece contains no mention of his latest revelations. We will not cease in our efforts to turn this into a massive story, but we need your support. The links are there. Get the story. Email it out to every person, newspaper, newswire, and TV station in existence. One person in the mainstream media did actually cover it, and it was Keith Olbermann.
and our winner, Vice President Cheney. Seymour Hersh's reporting sometimes seems way out there, but usually he winds up having actually understated reality. So let's just keep this in the probably file for now. He told the Campus Progress Journalism Conference that in a meeting in the Vice President's office, members of the administration sat around brainstorming ideas to provoke a war with Iran. Quote, "The one that interested me the most was, why don't we in our shipyard, build four or five boats that look like Iranian PT boats, put Navy SEALs on them with a lot of arms, and the next time one of our boats goes to the Straits of Hormuz, start a shoot-up. Might cost lives, and it was rejected because you can't have Americans killing Americans." That's the kind of, that's the level of stuff we're talking about. Provocation, but that was rejected. Can you see this happening in Cheney's office? Sure you can. Can you see Cheney getting all happy and worked up and almost smiling? Sure you can. Can you see when they get to the part about Americans being killed and you can't do that, and he just stares at them all and says, "So?" Vice President Dick Cheney, today's worst person in the world.
But they would never do something like 9/11. They would only dress up Navy SEALs like Iranians and have a shoot-up. They would only fake the Gulf of Tonkin attack, or the USS Maine, or the USS Liberty, or the World Trade Center bombings in 93, or Oklahoma City, or Foot and Mouth, or Lyme disease, or Operation Big City, or the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. They wouldn't do that. It's just incompetence. Jumping to the hotspot of Denver, Denver Post, Boulder NIST plutonium mishap, whoops, draws stern rebuke. A project to enhance the United States' ability to detect dirty bombs went awry at the Boulder campus of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, where dangerous plutonium sources were obtained without management approval and handled by inexperienced and untrained researchers, according to a scathing review released. The result, said the 62-page report by the NIST Ionizing Radiation Committee, with a link to the 60-page, 62-page PDF for you, the result was the spread of plutonium contamination at the lab and into the Boulder sewer system. Specifically, the investigators found three plutonium sources were acquired without adequate hazard analysis or management approval. When the plutonium was received, all protective barriers were removed except the screw-topped glass bottle in a sealed plastic bag. Inexperienced and untrained researchers worked on the project. And finally, fourth, the work area was neither restricted nor controlled for radiological work and was in a busy, multi-use laboratory. So it was a Boulder NIST plutonium whoops. So, to my friends listening on KBFR, you better watch out. If we jump to the Associated Press and back to the presidential selection, Ron Paul followers pose danger for McCain in the West. This is, again, from the Associated Press. Dueling delegations pitting Ron Paul's Nevada supporters against those of John McCain vow to take their fight to the RNC. That's just one sign that the outsider internet-fueled movement led by the feisty Republican congressman from Texas remains afloat in the wake of McCain's victory in the GOP primaries. In the libertarian-leaning West, where Paul's message of distrust of the federal government and ardent individualism played particularly well, there is talk of GOPers straying from McCain. Libertarian candidate Bob Barr has emerged as a favorite alternative for Paul activists, followed by Constitutional Party candidate Chuck Baldwin. Although, I would have to go with probably Cynthia McKinney. Even if the numbers of dissenters are small, in tight contests in key western states, they could spoil McCain's chances, experts say. In Nevada, there's absolutely enough to have an effect on the election, said Chuck Muth, a leading conservative activist in a state in which early polls show McCain and Obama in a statistical tie. Returning again to the DNC in Colorado and Boulder yet again, Colorado Fusion Center to gather intel during the DNC. Federal and state law enforcement officials will increase intel ops during the DNC, overseeing an information war room that will be staffed around the clock with analysts who access a dozen databases while receiving reports of, quote, suspicious activity. Activity that some civil libertarians claim could be nothing more than engaging in anti-war protests or photographing federal facilities that could be targeted for terrorist attack. central to the efforts is Colorado's Fusion Center, a place designed to facilitate intel sharing among federal, state, and military agencies in an effort to prevent terrorism. But civil rights advocates fear that Colorado Information Analysis Center, CIAC, now housed in an inconspicuous office building in Centennial, a southern suburb of Denver, could enable unwarranted spying on Americans exercising their First Amendment rights at the convention. Inside the building, intelligence analysts with the Colorado State Patrol, Colorado National Guard, and the Colorado FBI take local reports of suspicious criminal activity and determine what merits further investigation. I know what needs further investigation, and it ain't us. Returning to the nightmare of airport security and our good friends at the TSA, they're now performing emotional screening of passengers.
Airport security isn't just concerned with what's in your bags anymore. They're now trained to assess what's going on in your mind. The TSA screening looks for involuntary physical or psychological reactions to indicate stress, fear, or deception. All new at 6, KXAN's Jenny Hopp tells us travelers think of being watched and judged without even knowing.
Well, we all know what you can't bring on planes, but what if security starts looking for something intangible, such as psychological distress? TSA says it's something that's necessary to keep you safe on planes.
It's a security measure rolling into airports across the country.
I disagree with the idea.
One that's supposed to detect what you can't with a quick scan or unlock with the flip of a zipper.
If Austin wants to become an international airport, I think it needs that kind of a security measure.
They're called behavior detection officers, TSA employees who are trained to clue into a traveler's psyche.
We're not just looking for things anymore, but we're looking for actual people.
They're looking for people who display stress, fear, or deception.
Some people get nervous about smaller things than others, so I don't think nervousness and fidgetiness is a good idea.
There are certain thresholds that this individual needs to meet in our behavioral detection program. We don't just see someone who's nervous and pull them over to talk with them.
TSA says there's no profiling involved in the screening, and officers go through a week-long class that includes cultural sensitivity training.
No one wants a rights infringed upon, but if you're not doing anything wrong, what are you worried about?
So we've heard what others think about this issue, but what do you think? We've set up a forum where you can voice your opinion. It's attached to this story at KXAN.com. At ABIA, Jenny Hawk, KXAN, Austin News.
A whole week of training. Wow. So, if you show your hand or betray your hidden emotions that you're maybe a little pissed off at undertrained, overstaffed TSA workers are making you take off your shoes and have your grandma dump her water and scanning World War II vets. Don't show that you're mad about that. Show that you're happy being a slave, or the TSA's behavior detection officers will get you. Last couple stories. Let's hurry it up. This again from Raw Story. Ralph Nader says Obama supporters are in political slavery. During a press conference and campaign rally attended by, Raw Story, independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, VoteNader.org, claimed that liberals and Democrats who will vote for Senator Barack Obama as the, quote, least worst candidate are actually trapped in political slavery. At the campaign stop in, yet again, Austin, Texas, Nader spoke to an audience of approximately 200 about his campaign's primary issues in the 2008 presidential election. During the press conference held in a sweltering classroom at the back of a small suburban Methodist church, Nader also directly addressed an elderly white woman as a political bigot. So using quite racially charged language, Ralph Nader. Returning to Denver, yet again, Denver area emergency response trainers train for DNC. Emergency responders, this is from CBS4 out of Denver, emergency responders around the Denver area were working on drills over the weekend in the event of a major problem during the DNC.
The blood on her face is fake, but the scenario could be real. A bus loaded with tourists collides with cars on I-70.
We like to prepare for the worst, but hope for the best. So these scenarios are always important because there's always the chance that something like this is going to happen.
Most of the 10 first responder agencies training here are filled with volunteers. The practice is welcome, and more so than ever, since the eyes of the world will be on Denver next month.
Our specific agency covers a large portion of I-70. We do see several large incidents on the highway. And of course, with large events like the DNC coming to town, we always have the potential for a larger scale incident.
Hi, American Red Cross. This is Meg. How can I help you?
The Red Cross has been busy also. For more than a year, the relief agency, known for providing aid and comfort to disaster victims, has been planning for the DNC and the unknown.
Do you run worst-case scenarios of downtown Denver needing to be evacuated? Well, we've never done that.
Helping the cause is this advanced communications truck, recently delivered to the Denver Red Cross. 1 hour after arriving, it can provide the kind of service that would normally take 24 hours. But as Robert Thompson of the Red Cross explained, whether it's needed or not, shelter and food plans are already in place, and he knows they better be.
Just make sure that we have all of our ducks in a row, because if we don't, we'll be the first ones to hear about it.
More terror PSYOP drills in Denver. Now, which predictive programming scenario will play out, whether it'll be like from The Dark Knight or from Jericho or even 24, you know, the first season. We'll see. Last couple articles. A good one, again, from Lynn Hart at Existentialist Cowboy, The Enemy is Us, where he explores the idea of a Frankensteinian demise and Mary Shelley and monsters of our own creation. Finally, though, from Bloomberg, GM and Ford on the verge of bankruptcy. General Motors Corp. and Ford Motor, the two biggest U.S. automakers, have about a 46% chance of default within 5 years, according to Edward Altman, a finance professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. Both are in very serious shape, and the markets reflect that. Altman, the creator of the Z-score mathematical formula, with a link you can read about that, that measures bankruptcy risk, said in an interview with Bloomberg Television. The model shows that these companies are, quote, on the verge of bankruptcy, end quote. Yet again, infrastructure demise, America's for sale, Goodfellas burning it down. But that's going to do it for episode 86 of Media Monarchy. It's 888, August 8th, 2008. Coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority, Revere Radio Network, KBFR, and Ground Zero Radio, and more. However, what we need to do, it was a busy one. It's 2 weeks worth of creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com. And I post all these up, and you can check out the Google searches, and you can check out the companies and the ISPs and all that. But we had the Four Seasons in New York. Somebody Googled scanner frequencies, Bluefield Police, West Virginia. Hewlett-Packard Googled NASA Phoenix Secret. The Boulder County government visited, as well as the Maersk Oil North Sea UK company. The DOD Network Information Center out of Columbus Googled Black Hellos over Denver. Kent State University, somebody Googled DoubleTree Pentagon video. Honeywell, private military industrial complex contractors out of New York, Googled Internet 2 2012. Somebody at Catholic Healthcare West Googled Bill O'Reilly F-bomb MP3. Somebody at Expedia out of Bellevue, Washington Googled Media Monarchy. We had America West Airlines Googling lawsuit against Boeing 9/11. The first of many, many visits by SAIC, Science Applications International, out of San Diego, reading about their conflict of interest and removing themselves from the bidding for the, at the moment, suspended top all five. We had George Washington University reading about it. We had the Louisiana Board of Regents Google John Kennedy Jr. and the Montauk Project. We had Andrews and Kurth out of Houston Google SAIC top off contract. We had the Leon County Board of County Commissioners out in New York City Google Anderson Cooper's ugly secrets, which, of course, he's a Vanderbilt heir, Yale graduate. U.S. Department of Energy out of Montgomery Village in Maryland, they were reading about the nuclear agency head dismissed for lapses. The Army Information Systems Command in Alexandria Googled U.S. Weapons Armory. FEMA out of Springfield, we're reading about, of course, FEMA suspending top off. We had United Technologies Research Center Googled Plum Island Lab. more and more visits from SAIC and even a public relations firm called Ogilvy out of D.C. We had the Navy Network Information Center out of Arlington, Google National Public Radio, Bangor assassination plot. The guy picked up in Florida, said he's from Bangor, Maine, made death threats about Bush and Obama. We had the Boeing company reading about top off in SAIC. Waltonen Engineering, they Googled Ray Geisel Truth Rising. Truth Rising is the new documentary from Alex Jones. Ray Geisel was the guy arrested for making death threats. More visits from SAIC. We also had the Navy Network Information Center again. We had Network Innovations, Army Recreations, Fort Riley, Googled Bible Code, Mitt Romney. And finally, First American Credco out of Beaverton, Oregon. Someone there Googled two Oswald wallets, which of course there were, and we covered that previously on MediaMonarchy.com. So that's going to do it. This is episode 86. Keep an eye out for more. I've got tons to go into with the Amerithrax suicides and all the contradictions that entail that story. There's also going to be stuff from Richard Andrew Grove and a film to end all wars. More from Alex answering outside the box, and more and more and more. So keep your eyes peeled to MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. I love you. I thank you for tuning in and spreading the word, because only if we all work together can we look up above and stop looking down below and divide and conquer and fight with each other. So like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.